Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us this evening Joan Mellon, who's a professor, teaches English at a major university. She's written a number of excellent books, but for 8 years she has researched the story of Jim Garrison, the crusading district attorney from New Orleans, who held a trial some years after President Kennedy was assassinated. And in that trial, Jim Garrison stated that he felt that there was a conspiracy to kill President Kennedy. It originated in New Orleans, where Lee Harvey Oswald had lived, and had been associated with a couple of gentlemen, one of them a fellow named Ferry, another man named Clay Shaw. And Ferry, of course, died under rather strange circumstances before the trial. Clay Shaw was indicted and tried, and because of tremendous pressure brought to bear by the FBI and the CIA, why everything was done to thwart the investigation and the trial, and Clay Shaw was exonerated. Well, the thing is, why would the FBI and the CIA be involved in this case at all? What part did the government intelligence agencies play in the assassination and the murder of an American president? And Joan has done a great deal of work on this. She's been through many of the files that were released during the early years of the Clinton administration, going into the background of the material that had been suppressed from the American people for almost 30 years. And Joan, thank you so much for being with us this evening.
Good evening, Stan.
Well, why don't you tell us, our listeners, what motivated you to invest 8 years of your life in this book?
I knew Jim Garrison. I'd met him in 1969, and I was tremendously impressed by his dedication. Indeed, any great work is a result of obsession. And Jim Garrison was obsessed by finding out what happened to President Kennedy. He called President Kennedy Jack. He felt close to him, and no one else was doing it. Jim Garrison said Lee Harvey Oswald lived in his jurisdiction from, as Stan says, April to September 1963, and Garrison asked the rhetorical question, what should I do? Should I have stood back? And he didn't stand back, unlike nearly everyone else, certainly unlike the authorities in Texas, who caved into a pressure from Washington, D.C., and did no investigation at all. Although the death of President Kennedy was not a federal crime in 1963, the Texas authorities did nothing. And here's Jim Garrison in New Orleans trying to find out what happened and how, and he discovered that the planning for the assassination occurred in not only in New Orleans, but also in cities north of Baton Rouge. And for this, Garrison was vilified. He's vilified to this day. There's a new article attacking Jim Garrison right now coming out in the next issue of The Nation magazine. And this is a magazine that once had a liberal tradition, no longer. And I think Garrison never cared. One day one of his sons asked Garrison, how can you stand all these attacks? And Garrison said, and this line is in Oliver Stone's film JFK, what do you expect from a pig but a grunt?
Well, I think that you're going to have to just back your telephone receiver away from your mouth. We're getting a little back feed there, but this is such an important story, and it's such an important book because it goes into the background of Garrison. Garrison plays a very important part in the story. Jim Garrison was a patriot. He was a fascinating individual, not necessarily a terribly moral man, but a terribly dedicated man who wanted to find out who killed an American president and why there was such a cover-up and why anybody who tries to find out the truth is immediately demonized. Well, this is Dr. Stan, I guess Joan Mellon, and we're talking about her book, Farewell to Justice, a fascinating insight into what happened. And one of the things that really interests me is that there's so many books written about the assassination, and most of them are put out with an intentional effort to confuse the reader. This book is not put out to confuse the reader. It's not subsidized by our government or by intelligence agencies. And to this very day, they're doing everything they can to conceal the truth from the American people, because if the American people knew the truth about what really happened to President Kennedy, and the fact that they can coordinate the intelligence agencies and the media of America to cover up the truth, they may be able to begin asking what really happened at Ruby Ridge, what really happened at the Murrah Building, what really happened when TWA 800 went down, what really happened on September 11th. But because they were able to cover up the assassination of President Kennedy and of Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King and what happened at Pearl Harbor, they can pretty well control everything today. Now, one of the things that you pointed out was that there were actually directives put out by J. Edgar Hoover ordering the FBI agents not to give any information to Garrison. What was that all about?
That's right, Stan. People have the mistaken belief that the CIA and the FBI were rival agencies. In fact, we find in the new documents that they have mutual cooperation treaties that go back to the founding of the CIA. And J. Edgar Hoover put out a directive against Jim Garrison to all special agents in charge, saying, give Garrison nothing. And he directed his attention, Hoover did, to the special agent in charge in New Orleans. His name was Robert Reitmeier. And Hoover wrote, tell Reitmeier to keep his own mouth shut and keep all the people in New Orleans keep their mouth shut. And above all, they were not to tell Garrison about leads that were coming into the FBI about the Kennedy assassination. And as we know later, the Department of Justice made telephone calls to the governors of all the states where Garrison was trying to extradite witnesses back to New Orleans. Not a single witness was extradited back to Orleans Parish Grand Jury. So Garrison really couldn't possibly do his investigation. And as I like to quote, when people ask Garrison, how did you think you could prosecute anyone for the crime of conspiracy and the murder of President Kennedy in a state court in Louisiana, Garrison was bemused, and he just said, I guess I thought I was living in the country I was born in. In the country he was born in, there was a freedom of the press, there was a system of justice, and I think, as Stan says, I think this is really one of my most important points. When the press decided to rubber stamp the Warren Report and give out the false conclusion that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone, when they did that, that is the moment that the press, 1964, is the moment that the press became embedded and began to be an organ of official power rather than being free.
Hold that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan right here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Joan Mellon, her book, Farewell to Justice. It's the story, really, of Jim Garrison's effort. Of course, Jim Garrison was the district attorney of New Orleans, and it was his effort to indict Clay Shaw, who was a CIA agent, and the CIA was intimately involved with the whole planning of the assassination of Kennedy, but I believe the FBI was involved as well, and they all knew exactly what was going on. And I'm sure the mafia was involved and the oil men were involved. And certainly they put out all sorts of decoys and false stories, because how could they let the American people know that this was a coup d'etat? They were going to kill the President of the United States and replace him with a man who would do what they wanted rather than what he wanted to do. I think John Kennedy's biggest mistake was to think that he was the President of the United States and he was free to do what he wanted to do. And the reality is, if you are the President of the United States, you do what you're told to do. Ronald Reagan tried to do what he wanted to do initially, and then, of course, there was an assassination attempt on his life. Who was it who tried to assassinate him? Why, the son of a very close friend of the former director of the Central Intelligence Agency, who at that time was the Vice President of the United States, George Herbert Walker Bush. And so, I think Reagan pretty well got the message, and after that he did what he was supposed to do if he wanted to live out his years and in the White House. Unfortunately, I think Jim Garrison wrote a book. It was called The Heritage of Stone. Wasn't that it?
That's right. Jim Garrison wrote 3 books, and his first book was called The Heritage of Stone. He wrote another book at the end of his life, which was a memoir of his investigation, and that one is called On the Trail of the Assassins, in which he describes his investigation. Garrison wanted to be a writer, and I want to stress he didn't want to be a politician. He could have been governor of the state of Louisiana. He chose instead really to do nothing but investigate the assassination of President Kennedy until the federal government stopped him and they indicted him on false charges of taking bribes from pinball gambling interests in New Orleans.
And, of course, they actually would like to have sent him to prison on trumped-up charges. They do that with any politician who tries to get the truth out. They've sent honest congressmen to prison. They've sent people who they knew were innocent to prison. One man, FBI, had nothing to do with politics. He was just a man. And the FBI was covering up for one of their mafia assassinations. And so they sent this innocent man to prison for 30 years. And that's told in a wonderful book, Dangerous Alliance, that goes into the background of Whitey Bulger, which used to carry the book. It's out of print now. But, I mean, unfortunately, this is not the America that we would like it to be. Because I feel that very sinister forces are working in our society. Well, after your analysis, and of course you spent 8 long years putting together the book, what is your impression? Do you think that Playshaw was involved? Do you think that Lee Harvey Oswald was really an intelligence asset, probably for the military and for the FBI and the CIA? What are your thoughts?
My farewell to justice states, and I think I show with the 1,000 interviews with, hundreds of thousands of documents, that the clandestine service of the CIA planned the assassination of President Kennedy. And here we're talking about the deputy director for plans, Richard Helms. We're talking about the people under him, such as David Atlee Phillips. We're also talking about the general counsel of the CIA, Lawrence Houston, who knew about all of this. And all these same people were involved in the overthrow of President Arbenz in Guatemala in 1954. We see the same people operating first abroad and then within the United States as well. I think the FBI helped to cover it up. I think Lee Harvey Oswald, as Jim Garrison said, Jim Garrison began his investigation when he learned that Lee Harvey Oswald was an FBI informant. He was working for the New Orleans field office of the FBI. Then Garrison learned and figured out that Oswald was a low-level Central Intelligence agent who had been part of the false defector program into the Soviet Union, which was run by CIA Counterintelligence and James Angleton. And I discovered in the course of my research that Oswald was also working for U.S. Customs in New Orleans, and I found that information in the Church Committee papers, where one of the customs officers in New Orleans says to the people from the Church Committee, "I've been waiting 10 years for somebody to talk to me." And he reveals that Oswald was also with U.S. Customs, as were many CIA agents. We have to look at the evidence and see that the CIA and Customs exchanged agents on a regular basis.
I think really what's so interesting is the way that they created this image of Lee Harvey Oswald. Oh, he was pro-communist. He defected to the Soviet Union. Oh, he was passing out pamphlets for the Fair Play for Cuba Committee supporting Fidel Castro. All of this was to create an image for the mind of the American people. Would that be a fair statement?
Well, it would, Stan. I think what Oswald thought is that he was working for the overthrow of Fidel Castro, for the assassination of Fidel Castro that the CIA had been trying to do for some time and were continuing to do. So that's how Oswald was drawn into the crime, and that's why Oswald wanted to get into Cuba, and therefore he was going to show that he was pro-Castro, and therefore he was giving out leaflets on the street of New Orleans that said Fair Play for Cuba, which was an organization sponsored by the Socialist Workers' Party. And when we look at the CIA documents, what we find is that Fair Play for Cuba was heavily infiltrated by the CIA, and it was a special project of David Atlee Phillips. We also have evidence that David Atlee Phillips was seen in Dallas with Lee Harvey Oswald. And, of course, we have Garrison's evidence north of Baton Rouge that Oswald had attempted to get a job at the East Louisiana State Hospital at Jackson. So we see the preparing for what the Warren Report ultimately would say, which was that Oswald was insane, he was unstable, he was dangerous, he was a sociopath, and therefore he killed President Kennedy alone and without Confederates.
And of course, then of course they had to get rid of Lee Harvey Oswald because he was really extremely bright and intelligent, and when he realized that he was a patsy, he might have talked. So they arranged to have Jack Ruby go in and shoot him down. Why would Jack Ruby, who was a low-level mafia hoodlum, why would he risk his life and go in there into the police station there in Dallas and Parkland police station, the police station in Dallas, and shoot Lee Harvey Oswald, knowing full well he'd be caught and tried for murder? That doesn't make sense.
I think, Stan, that Jack Ruby was forced to do it. I think he was an assignment and he had no choice. I think he was really. Garrison said that Jack Ruby was a member of the mafia branch of the CIA. We see, as you say, Jack Ruby's long mafia connections, some kind of involvement with a murder in Chicago. I think that he was threatened. There's no other way, because, of course, Jack Ruby knew that he'd be arrested.
I think that he got, as they like to say in the mafia, he got an offer he couldn't refuse, and that book is, the story is told in a book we carry called Double Cross, which is written by the brother of the head of the central of the mafia, Chuck Giancano. So when you begin putting these things together, there's so many unanswered questions. Well, now, what was the proof that Garrison had about Clay Shaw, and how was it that he really couldn't convince the jury, or was it simply because he was blocked at every turn by our government?
We have to remember that the files of Clay Shaw, which show that Clay Shaw was a CIA operative, were not available to Jim Garrison. Just as the FBI tried to stop him, the CIA gave him nothing either. And so Garrison was going by intuition. One of the things he had was a set of newspapers called Paese Sera, published in Rome, which were exposing a CIA trade operation infiltrating European electoral politics in France, particularly in Italy. And Clay Shaw was a member of the board of directors of this CIA front. But Garrison had already arrested Clay Shaw before he saw those Paese Sera newspapers. Now, newspapers are not admissible in court. They're hearsay. And so Garrison really didn't have any, he didn't have the proof. Now, in 1992, when the JFK Act was passed and the documents became available, suddenly we see document after document where Clay Shaw is doing assignments for the CIA. He is not just a mere businessman being debriefed. What he's doing is he's told what to do, he's told what to look for, he goes and does it, and then he gives his report. We know that his files reside in the operations sections of the CIA. We know that Clay Shaw was a member of a project called QK Enchant, which meant that you could use ordinary citizens for CIA projects, and we even have a new document which showed that among the people who was recruited under QK Enchant, and of course we have to conclude that was Clay Shaw, since he was the only member of QK Enchant in New Orleans. One of the people that Clay Shaw recruited was Guy Bannister. Now, Guy Bannister ran a detective agency. He was played by Ed Asner in the movie, if those remember JFK. Guy Bannister ran a detective agency, and what was interesting, at 531 Lafayette Street in New Orleans, what's interesting is that Lee Harvey Oswald, when he gave out his leaflets, some of those leaflets had the address 544 Camp Street written on them. Well, 544 Camp Street was the side door of Guy Bannister's agency. So Guy Bannister really is in the midst of all of this, and many witnesses testified that Lee Harvey Oswald had a quote-unquote office on the second floor of Guy Bannister's detective agency. So we see Bannister being connected to Shaw, David Ferry being connected to Lee Harvey Oswald, David Ferry, the contract pilot who was the head of the Civil Air Patrol troop, and Oswald had been a member of that in the 1950s when he was a teenager, and Shaw and Oswald and David Ferry traveled together up north of Baton Rouge to Clinton and Jackson, to that hospital. All of these are connected, and Garrison was able to put together most of this evidence that shows exactly how the plot was implemented in the state of Louisiana 3 months before the shooting in Dealey Plaza.
But, of course, it was all more or less speculation on his part, had he had the government documents, but, of course, they were suppressed. And, you know, it's really interesting. When those documents were made public in the early 1990s, why didn't the American people hear that Clay Shaw, who had been, of course, indicted by Jim Garrison, being part of a CIA plot to kill the President of the United States, why didn't we ever hear that Clay Shaw, by the CIA's own documents, had actually been a CIA contract operator?
Well, I think the answer to that goes to the mainstream press. And I think we can't help but point out that the New York Times has not printed one word against the Warren Report in all these years.
And I bet they didn't give you a very good book review on your book, did they?
They never reviewed my book, and one of my students asked me if they had, and my question to the student is, did you think they would? It's inconceivable.
And I think that until the American people understand, our major media is controlled. The New York Times prints all the news that they want to print. The Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal and Time and Newsweek and U.S. News and World Report and National Review and Reader's Digest all tie in my estimation, to what I refer to as the Brotherhood of Darkness. Their purpose is not to reveal, but to conceal the truth. And if you doubt that, well, you'll have to get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, and the book, The New Media Monopoly. Well, this is Dr. Stan here. Our guest this evening is Joan Mellon. She's written an excellent book, Farewell to Justice, and we certainly recommend this to anybody of our listeners, and we'll tell you a little later about how to get that. But certainly this book, Farewell to Justice, is the story of Clay Shaw's effort to bring out the truth about the assassination of President Kennedy. And, of course, he was then immediately targeted by our intelligence agencies. How did that case where they tried to send him to prison on trumped-up illegal charges that he'd accepted bribes, how did he get out of that?
Well, what happened was the National Security Agency, about whom we hear so much in the newspapers today, had an operative named Walter Sheridan, who also worked for Bobby Kennedy. And Walter Sheridan went down to New Orleans and bribed Garrison's former chief investigator and friend, Pershing Gervais, and said, if you don't help us to get Jim Garrison, you're going to go to jail yourself for income tax fraud, and you'll be in jail for 8 years. And Gervais didn't want to do it because, not that he was a saint, far from it, but because he didn't see any profit to himself in it, but he had no choice. And so he went along with it, and he had tapes, he altered the tapes, he attempted to implicate Jim Garrison, and then finally the National Security Agency could not control Pershing Gervais, and so Gervais was in the witness protection program in Canada. He telephoned a New Orleans reporter named Rosemary James, and he asked her to come to Canada to talk to him, and then he repudiated everything. He said that the Department of Justice had forced him to criticize Jim Garrison, that Jim Garrison never took any money, that he never did any of those things, never took the bribes. And then Gervais adds at one point, Mr. Garrison, he didn't have a nickel. And that was true. Garrison didn't have any money, wasn't interested in money. He never even cashed the National Guard checks that he had from his salary of working in the National Guard. So I think that whole at the pinball trial, Jim Garrison represented himself at the end, and a very moving, important closing statement. Garrison talks about himself, and he says, the last perfect person walked on the earth 2,000 years ago, but he didn't do it. And the jury listened. Several jurors were weeping, I heard. And he was acquitted. I should add that as a result of all this, lasted for several years. Garrison was exhausted. He was financially exhausted, and he was unable to put up a campaign. And he lost the race for district attorney in 1973.
But he eventually was elected as a judge there, wasn't he? The people, because the people could see through the government's effort to get him. Well, he was targeted by the government because he was trying to tell the truth. And how many innocent people are rotting in prisons in America today? Because we have immoral people at the highest levels of our government, working in the Attorney General's office, working in the CIA, working in the NSA, working in the FBI, targeting innocent people. Why? Because they cannot let the American people know about the degree of evil that it really does exist in our government. And it exists because the good people are not involved and not willing to commit themselves in the defense of courageous people like Jim Garrison. Certainly not a saint. As you read the book, you find that he had a lot of very human frailties, but one of them was not being dishonest. He tried to do what he thought was right under all circumstances. I would disagree on some of the things that positions he took, but he believed in them. He could rationalize them, and he felt he was an honest man. I think he was an honest man too, and I can disagree with honest men, but at least he did what he thought was right. And they tried to destroy him because he wanted to tell the American people the truth about the murder of an American president by our own intelligence agencies. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening, Joan Mellon. Her book, Farewell to Justice. Joan, how can people get your book?
People can get my book at Amazon.com. Give the full title of my book. It's A Farewell to Justice, Jim Garrison, JFK's Assassination, and the Case That Should Have Changed History. It's published by Potomac Books, Inc., and you need the INC there. Potomac Books, Inc. You can get it on Amazon.com. You can look for it on my website, joanmellon.net, where I also put a lecture that I gave at the Ethical Culture Society in New York relating the Kennedy assassination to current events today, the Patriot Act, the National Security Agency surveillance, the use of torture in Abu Ghraib and other places, and so forth. And I have that lecture is right on the website, on the homepage. It's joanmellon.net. And you could also get my book at Barnes & Noble, of course, Borders, and big bookstores like that. I hope small bookstores, too. But I have a very small publisher. They had the courage to publish this book, and I'm not going to have the distribution that you would have if somebody like Random House published the book. I think that these big publishing companies, because I've published with the big companies before, my last book, Hellman & Hammett, was published by HarperCollins. And but I think with a subject like this, where, as Stan said, we're talking about a coup d'etat, we're talking about what Jim Garrison called the war machine and a change in politics drastically since the time of President Kennedy, these ideas are really very difficult. I think the one subject that's taboo in this country remains what happened in the Kennedy assassination.
And, of course, for our listeners out there, if you want to know what really happened to the publishing industry, today we have five mega corporations that control the publishers, they control the news magazines, they control the newspapers, they control the television networks. It's beautifully covered in a book called The New Media Monopoly. You must understand the media is controlled. And so you're not going to get a book that's going to tell you the truth published by Random House or HarperCollins or any of the establishment publishing houses. If you can control the flow of information, you can control what people hear, what people see, what people read, and ultimately what people believe. And that's why I do what I do, and I'm sure that's why Joan has invested 8 years of her life in this effort to get the truth out about it. Have you had any pressure put on you to back away from this issue?
Not really, Stan. It's just that I knew I wouldn't be reviewed in the major media, and I'm used to being reviewed. I knew that I wouldn't get the rewards that authors usually get as a result of so much work, so many years, so much effort. But I think I was inspired by Jim Garrison. I didn't care. I sort of felt what same thing he felt when he said on Dutch television, nothing else matters. And then I started out writing a biography of Jim Garrison. I went into a biography of his investigation, how far he went. And then A Farewell to Justice is really my own investigation of the Kennedy assassination based on documents that have emerged even in the year 2005, or the year that the book came out last November. So I've done everything I could possibly do. There are attacks on me on a daily basis. As I mentioned, this recent cartoonish article in The Nation magazine, there have been articles in the last 5 years attempting to stop me by attacking Jim Garrison year in and year out. Garrison died in 1992, and I would argue if Garrison wasn't right, if he wasn't a threat to power, why would they continue the character assassinations of Jim Garrison continue to this day?
And you notice that they always say, think kindly of the dead, and yet there are certain people that you will hear, you'll see motion pictures put out to discredit them to this day, and books and articles, everything. The certain people who've tried to tell the American people the truth are constantly demonized by the controlled media to create the impression in your mind they had to be kooks, they had to be irresponsible. And, of course, it wasn't just Jim Garrison. There have been other people who've tried to tell the American people the truth, and they'll put movies out about them, and they'll get Academy Awards, you know. Why? Because that's how they create the reality of the American people. Now, I think this is an important book. It's a very well-written book, very well-researched book. I mean, how many footnotes do you have in that? Just a tremendous number of footnotes.
I have 80 pages of notes going back to the documents at the National Archives or to my interviews, because I wanted people to go out, look at the documentation, go read it yourselves. All the documents are available in the National Archives, with the exception of one document that I quote that was given to me by a very important witness named Thomas Edward Beckham, who was set up by the CIA to be the patsy should Oswald not have cooperated. Should Oswald have fled, they had to have someone else in reserve. And one of the people who infiltrated Jim Garrison's investigation, a man named Gordon Novell, said, how many Oswalds did they have out there ready to go? One of the interesting documents that was seen at the CIA headquarters by the investigators for the House Select Committee on Assassinations lists the CIA plants in Jim Garrison's office. And so there you can see the names. And among those names, of course, Pershing Gervais is one. Other people who were working as Garrison's assistant district attorneys were reporting to the FBI and the CIA and so forth.
In fact, the thing is that I know very well, even in what I do, they've tried to infiltrate my organization. They've infiltrated my good friend Pat Matriciana's organization because he'd put out a video about, well, critical of President Kennedy, and even his best friends were FBI informants. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and as I was saying, we live in a surveillance society. And in fact, many years ago, 40 years ago, I was approached and actually asked to become a government undercover agent, simply go to cocktail parties and send in reports of what I was said, what people were saying right here in the little town of Santa Cruz where I live. And I don't know how many other people actually are informants or informing on others, thinking they're doing the patriotic thing, without realizing, of course, they're being used by, in my estimation, very evil and wicked forces to keep the American people from learning the truth. But if you try to get the truth out, why, you could very well find your best friend as a government agent, as happened over and over again. And most of our conservative organizations and many of our Christian organizations, and I'm sure many of our liberal organizations, are infiltrated by people who are there, not to, to help, but actually to be there to eventually discredit the people. And really, it must have been very discouraging for certainly Jim Garrison to realize that so many people working for him who he trusted in his own office were actually government agents, informants.
Well, Jim Garrison even had to admit himself. He said, "I'm naive and easily fooled." And I think even when the documents became available after Garrison's death, we find that some of the people closest to him were CIA operatives and agents. For example, an oil man in New Orleans named Joe Rault. And Joe Rault was a person who was part of Truth and Consequences, which was an organization of businessmen funding Garrison's investigation, attempting to help him because he had no money at all to run this. And then the documents reveal Rault in steady contact with the CIA station in Miami, JM Wave. I don't think Garrison ever knew that.
And of course, really, of course, they would put the money up so the Garrison would think they had to be on his side. And actually, they were working on the other side. This is the sort of thing they would do in Nazi Germany, sort of thing they would do in Stalin's Russia. But the same spiritual forces are at work within our society. And you have to understand, there really are people who are, of course, fear exposure, fear the truth coming out, and will do anything they can to discredit people who are trying to get to the truth. And of course, it is so vitally important that we still confuse the American people about the murder of JFK. And so to this very day, they bring out all sorts of new books to confuse the American people. And I suspect, Joan, before long there'll be another book out on Jim Garrison saying how wrong he was. I'm sort of waiting for that to come.
We're going to get a book that's going to say that Garrison was the dupe of the KGB, and the only reason he believed that Clay Shaw was the CIA operative because this was disinformation spread by the KGB, which is totally false. So I think we can look to that in the near future.
Hold that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and our guest, of course, is Joan Mellon. Her book, Farewell to Justice, an amazing book. And, of course, you'll find out, of course, that Lee Harvey Oswald worked for the CIA, worked for the FBI, worked for U.S. Customs Service. Those of you who remember the story, he had actually gone to Russia. Supposedly to defect. Oh, he hated America. He was actually an undercover government agent at the time, and the Soviets recognized that. And then, of course, he was allowed to marry the daughter, the niece of a colonel in the KGB, and then our State Department paid his way back in the United States. Why would our State Department pay the way back of a man who tried to defect to the Soviet Union?
I think they didn't realize that they would have a Jim Garrison. They thought they could do this with impunity because the evidence is so obvious if you really look at it. What is Oswald doing taking Russian lessons in the Marines? what is he doing subscribing to Pravda, and everybody laughing about it. It was really an open secret. And I want to mention, too, that we're talking about the freedom of the press and the fact that we are losing our freedom of the press. We still have radio programs like this. We still have some newspapers. I'm reminded of an article in the New York Observer recently, quoting, it was actually by a New York lawyer named Martin Garbus, who echoes Dr. Stan and talks about how he sees similarities between the America of today and Weimar Germany. And he said that we're in a very dangerous situation. Now, this is a very respectable New York civil liberties lawyer. It is not some kook, some far-out person. And so we still, I think what we have to do is to take advantage of our freedom as long as we have it, and to just shout out the truth. That's what Jim Garrison always said. People would ask him whether he feared that his life was in danger, and he would say, as soon as you have a piece of evidence, you have to go forward and make it public, and that way you've done everything that you can do. There's no need to get rid of you. There's no need to stop you.
And of course, he was a very, very courageous individual. And I think Oliver Stone, I would disagree with a lot of Oliver Stone's philosophy, but I think Oliver Stone did a great job on his book, of course, on JFK, pardon me, on his video on JFK. And, you know, and Oliver Stone was universally attacked by the liberal media, and here's one of the main spokesmen for the liberal side, and yet they certainly did everything they could to discredit Oliver Stone, because his motion picture, in large part, was really very accurate, wasn't it?
It was, and it's very interesting. The New York Times ran articles against Oliver Stone's film JFK 6 months before the film was even released, and these attacks were like every 2 weeks or every 3 days, or constant articles criticizing Oliver Stone in the New York Times. It was astonishing, really. And one of the New York Times columnists, a lawyer actually named Anthony Lewis, even wrote a column in which he accused Jim Garrison of, he said that Jim Garrison had been convicted of taking bribes, whereas in fact Garrison had been acquitted. So the truth really has, when it comes to the Kennedy assassination, the Warren Report, and the mainstream media, the truth is just a far-flung dream.
And of course, there's one scene in that motion picture where the colonel from the military is sitting on a park bench with Jim Garrison. Of course, I think it was James Sutherland. I forgot.
Donald Sutherland.
Donald Sutherland is sitting there with Kevin Costner, and you know, and of course, Sutherland, playing the part of the Marine colonel, pardon me, the Army colonel, is saying, you know, you've got to pursue this. There really was a conspiracy behind the assassination of Kennedy. Now, the truth of the matter was the colonel was a man named Fletcher Prouty. And I have interviews with Fletcher Prouty, which is still available from Radio Liberty, a two-hour interview with him. And, of course, they never sat on a park bench. But Prouty kept writing to Garrison and telling him he had been the liaison between the Pentagon and the CIA. And Fletcher Prouty knew from all of his contacts that the government had killed President Kennedy, and he was trying to get Garrison to, of course, follow through on this. Well, anyway, I'll never forget hearing Oliver Stone interviewed on television. And they would say, now, Mr. Stone, I mean, did that meeting between Jim Garrison and the colonel really take place on a park bench? And Oliver Stone would say, no, but, and then they'd cut him off for an interview for an advertisement. And two or three times I saw that same sequence. Now, they didn't really sit there on that park bench, did they?
No, well, Jim Garrison did not know Fletcher Prouty at the time of his investigation. He became friendly with him only years later.
Right.
However, the essence of that conversation forms the political structure of Jim Garrison, the meaning of Jim Garrison's investigation. And I think in defense of Oliver Stone, we have to be reminded that this was a dramatic film. It was a feature film. It had actors in it. It was, if you like, you can call it a fiction film, although it is very, very close to the truth of the Kennedy assassination. And I think Oliver Stone did it that way to be ensure that he would have a wide audience. If he just did a documentary film at that time, he wouldn't have had much of an audience. And I think people understood that some of the characters are composites, and certainly that scene with Fletcher Prouty never took place. But I don't think the meaning of it is wrong.
Absolutely not. And the thing was that Oliver Stone wanted to clarify that, and they would always bring in an interruption, an advertisement, because they could not let the American people know the truth, you know, about the background of, you know, these ideas. Well, let's go to John, who's calling us from Ohio. John, did you have a question for our guest?
Yeah, I'm really interested in this because I think this is often the so-called liberal, the fake liberals and the fake pseudo-liberals. I consider myself on the left. I have some disagreements with you, but you're absolutely right on this issue, because whenever there's anything that's going to really open the minds of, and eyes of people to just how evil this military-industrial complex is, they all join forces. And I noticed that you mentioned a nation, and I remember it was one of the main researchers, Mark Lane, who went and called the editor at that time of The Nation to bring some of this information, and the guy actually went apoplectic. He said, "I don't want to hear it." He practically put his hands in his ears and began to talk over him and hung up on him. And if you look at some of the role of the during the Vietnam War, it was the fake liberals who were secretly financed by the CIA who were actually the favorite propagandists for the Vietnam War, even over the open right-wingers, because they could claim that somehow they were a minor muckrakers, and then you could believe them. And then you look at the role of the media. The New York Times and Time Life at the time had that forged photograph of Oswald with Oswald's head on somebody else's body holding up the ramshackle Carcano carbine and two leftist newspapers, a proven forgery, and yet they put that with their vast photographic expertise, Time Life, all over the world to frame him up falsely as the assassin and as a leftist, when actually, as you say, he was a low-level CIA agent.
Right, right, John, we agree with everything you're saying, and you just keep listening, and you'll find out that both the left and the right are financed by exactly the same people. That way you always have a controlled opposition. It's happening during the time of Vietnam. It's happening today as far as the war in Iraq. But I agree with you. You're absolutely right. God bless you. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Okay, that was John calling from Ohio, and we will take some calls here. If you have a question for Joan, she's done a great job of putting together the information, the background of the investigation by Clay Shaw. But, of course, Clay Shaw did not have access to many of these papers. How many documents did they release there in the early 1990s that had been suppressed for so long? Why? Because they did not want the American people to know the truth.
I think that, Stan, we have at the National Archives now, I think somebody counted maybe 4 million documents. Now, mind you, we don't have everything. And I think I, at one point in the research, I discovered that the second in command at the New Orleans field office of the CIA, Hunter Leak, had told someone that after the assassination, he burnt many of the CIA records on Lee Harvey Oswald. So they knew Lee Harvey Oswald quite well at the CIA field office in New Orleans. And the rest of the documents he put in a truck and drove to Langley, Virginia himself. So we have, we certainly know that not every document is available. When the FBI went into Tulane University, and they walked in and they said they wanted to look at the Hale Boggs papers, and they had the permission of Mrs. Boggs, they removed from the library all references in the Hale Boggs. And Hale Boggs, of course, is a Louisiana congressman who was on the Warren Commission. The FBI removed from the Hale Boggs papers all references to the Kennedy assassination or to the Warren Commission. And when I found this out from the curator of papers at Tulane, I filed a Freedom of Information suit to get these documents back from the FBI, and of course we never heard a single word.
And of course the interesting thing is Hale Boggs was actually flying up in Alaska with Nick Begich's father. Nick is a friend of ours. Nick Begich's father was running for Congress, and their plane went down. And of course the FBI knew exactly where the plane was, and, of course, concealed that information so they would die of exposure.
I think that Hale Boggs had denounced J. Edgar Hoover on the floor of the House of Representatives shortly before that.
And, of course, you do not denounce J. Edgar Hoover, or your plane goes down, and of course, you're left to die. Could this thing really happen in America? Well, I've done interviews with Nick Begich where he tells the story, and eventually they were able to get the FBI records and find out they knew where Hale Boggs and where his father were. And they conceal the information and let them die. Let's go to Carol calling from Arkansas. Hi, Carol. How are you doing?
Good evening, Dr. Stan and Ms. Mellon.
Do you have a question for us?
Yes. I wonder, do you think that they feared John Kennedy? He was gaining immense popularity very rapidly and seemed destined for Congress or president or whatever really he wanted, it appeared.
You're speaking now of the son of the who died in an airplane accident, right?
Yeah, John Kennedy Jr., and the fact that his whole death seemed very strange.
Now, Joan, do you have any comment on that?
I don't, except to say when we look at Bobby Kennedy's death, which we know was not done by Sirhan, when we look at the Chappaquiddick incident and all the mysteries around that, we might speculate. But I want to say about my book, A Farewell to Justice, I try not to speculate. I try not to give any theories. I try just to present the evidence and to present evidence that can be documented. And I think these are very interesting questions, but we don't have the answers yet.
And I think that, Carol, the thing is that all we can do is speculate. Somebody's got to do the research. Joan's done a wonderful job on what she has. And, of course, we don't want to put her stick her neck out because, believe me, there are a lot of people there with great big sabers waiting to cut it off.
Sure. Thanks. I just thought she might have happened onto something since... You know, if he had gained a political position powerful enough, he might could have exposed a whole lot of what happened to his father.
Remember what happened to his uncle, Bobby Kennedy, who was actually supposedly shot by Saran Saran, who was standing in front of him, but, of course, the bullets all came in from behind.
Yeah.
And of course, the coroner who told the truth about that, they destroyed him as well. Thanks so very much. Let's go to Mike calling from Santa Cruz. Hi, Mike. How are you doing?
Hi, Stan. Earlier in the program, Joan was talking about the assassination of Kennedy was CIA. All right. But who told them to do it?
Well, that's an excellent question. What interest did the CIA represent? Brilliant question, because when we look at the CIA, we can't see this as an organization that's out there just at random. And I tried to discover what, and look, please look at the lecture that I gave on my website, joanmellon.net, where I tried to go into some of that evidence. We go back to President Eisenhower's warning against the military-industrial complex, and we have to add to that, and intelligence complex. When we look at the oil interests, when we look at the relationship of the CIA to the grandfather of the present president, and the person who drafted the charter for the CIA, Robert Lovett, was a partner of Prescott Bush at Brown Brothers Harriman. When we look at the long history of the oil interest and how George Bush, the father now, the first President Bush, was sent to Texas, and he was sent to Texas by people who were involved in defense industries, defense contracts. And we see how after President Kennedy was killed, and these companies that weren't doing very well suddenly are profiting enormously from the Vietnam War. We see that Halliburton has bought Brown & Root, and we know Brown & Root today from the enormous profits that they've made from the Iraq War. We see that Brown & Root profited as well from the Vietnam War. So these interests, these defense industries, defense contractors, oil interests, all of these, and the war machine, as Jim Garrison put it, the Pentagon, all of these were working together. The CIA is the instrument of the assassination. But you're absolutely right. It goes beyond that.
Okay, thanks very much, Mike. Okay. Let's go to Larry calling from Santa Cruz. Hi, Jerry. Larry, do you have a question?
Well, yes, actually, following on the heels of Mike's question there, the only book I've read, and your author is probably familiar with it, is the only book that goes to the top of the hierarchy and the whole history in our time doesn't make any sense until it's factored in. And that's in a book by Eric John Phelps called Vatican Assassins. And he covers the same material you've covered tonight. And
That's the idea that the Vatican is responsible for it, and the Jesuits. And I rather think there's other books that will tell you it's the Zionists and the Jews. And they're also.
Well, I'd like your author's opinion on what he thinks of Eric John Phelps. And
I haven't read it, I'm sorry to say.
Okay, fine.
I think you'd love that book.
And I think it's I think that there's a very conscious effort to confuse us, to give us so much information. We can't see the forest for the trees. Let's go to Jim from Missouri. Hi, Jim. How are you doing?
Good evening.
Jim, are you there?
Yes, sir.
Okay, go ahead.
Sorry. I was curious if George Bush or other than his succession, Lyndon Johnson's name appears. And by the way, one quick question first. Wasn't Hal Boggs the Speaker of the House when he disappeared?
I don't think so. Do you know that, Joan?
I don't know that for a fact. He certainly had been, but I don't know if he was at that very moment.
Oh, I see.
I just want to add one point about Hale Boggs. He's the person who got Garrison interested in the Kennedy assassination.
Uh-huh.
Because at this closed sessions of the Warren Commission, and Alan Dulles had told everybody also to keep their mouth shut, but Hale Boggs learned that Lee Harvey Oswald was an FBI informant. This is 1965. No, of course it's early 64. Well, when Hale Boggs sees Jim Garrison in Washington shortly after the publication of the Warren Report, and Hale Boggs tells Garrison that Oswald was not what he seemed, that he was with the FBI and so forth. This is what interested Garrison in picking up the investigation of the death of President Kennedy.
And that may very well have caused Hale Boggs' life. So anything else, Jim?
Was George Bush's name mentioned in your book?
I don't think he's mentioned in my book, although, of course, there are factors here. For example, the Bay of Pigs is mentioned in my book, and we know that one of the names for the Bay of Pigs operation was Zapata, and we know that the Bush family enterprises were called Zapata Offshore, their oil company. Yeah. So we see so many connections. We see that George Bush, and I think this is in my book, I take it back, I don't remember what's in my book sometimes, that George Bush, the father, was debriefed by the FBI after the Kennedy assassination.
Well,
why was this? I mean, that's, and then, of course, The Nation magazine, I should say, actually published this, and then the CIA denied it, and they said it's another George Bush. Of course, this is another low-level CIA operative also named George Bush, and then it turned out, of course, that wasn't true at all. It was the George Bush.
Well, is that the letter that J. Edgar Hoover wrote? I read in Jim Mars's book, I think it is, that they found a letter that J. Edgar Hoover had written in 1964 where he talked about George Bush of the CIA.
Right, that's it.
That's the one you're mentioning?
That's right.
Okay, thanks very much, Jim. Appreciate it. Anything else you want to ask?
Oh, no, sir.
All right, fine. Good to have you with us. Bye-bye. All right, fine. Well, we've got about 3 minutes more to wrap up the program, but certainly this is a fascinating subject, and it's something we should never forget. Because if they can kill an American president, get rid of it, and get away with it, could they have blown up the Murrah Building and gotten away with it? Could they have known what was going to happen to TWA 800 and allowed it to happen? What about the justification for our going to war in Iraq and Iran? Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Joan Mell and her book, Farewell to Justice, and I recommend it to you. Joan, is the book moving fairly well today?
Well, my book is in second printing, which I think is good, and I think, and I have to say, since a small publisher couldn't advertise, it's just Potomac Books, Inc., it's word of mouth that is selling the book, and I think a lot of people are reading it. I get an enormous response. No reviews, just a handful of reviews. But I think the book is doing well, and it's called A Farewell to Justice. It was a title that Jim Garrison wanted to use on his last book, eventually became On the Trail of the Assassins, but I decided I would use it anyway. He never used it. And, of course, the echo of Hemingway is contained there. And I want to mention also that it's a farewell, which means we are not bidding justice a complete farewell, that there's still a chance if we continue to speak out.
And I think it's so important what you have done, because certainly you're not some sort of right-wing flaming conspiratologist. You're a professor of English, aren't you?
Professor at Temple University in Philadelphia, and I'm in the English department. I teach a graduate program in creative writing, and I've written other books, very respectable works of scholarship. I have a doctorate, and I use the research tools that I've had, and I've used all my life for this book as well. So it's different in a way from some of the speculative books and the books that really are not by trained scholars.
And of course, the thing is that you could probably make a lot more money, writing books that would be widely circulated to the major publishers, but you sacrificed that. And I'm sure you knew from the very beginning this was not going to be a book that the establishment would welcome.
That's right. I sort of hoped maybe I'd get more of them, but I think that it's been uniformly attacked. I think the mainstream press stands together in covering up the Kennedy assassination.
And, of course, how can we have a free society when the press stands together, the right, the left, the conservative, the liberal, the Republican, the Democrat, and they're all covering up the truth about what happened on that fateful day in November of 1963, and I will never forget the day, and I'm sure that many of our listeners as old as I am will never forget that day, because that was a watershed event that changed the direction of America forever. Because if they could get away with killing an American president, why, they could accomplish whatever they want to. It led directly to the Vietnam War, and of course it led to changing immigration laws. It led to the changing of the morality of our country. It led to the beginning of the centralizing all power in government. And, of course, it began leading us towards the police state where we are today. Joan Ellen, thank you so very much for being with us. Thank you for having the courage to write that book.
Thank you, Stan. I appreciate being on your program.
And I hope maybe we can call on you from time to time again. You can keep us abreast of this because there's so much more in the book. We've just scratched the surface tonight.
Thank you very much.
Good night and God bless you. Bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I hope you enjoyed our program, and I hope many of you will be wanting to get the more information. Certainly, there are a number of books out there. That Joan Mellon's is an excellent book. We carry something called A Sniper Looks at Dealey Plaza. We have actually two four-tape sets on the Kennedy assassination, including an interview with Lee Harvey Oswald. You'll find that this was an extremely intelligent, articulate individual, and, that is, of course, in one of our four tape sets, along with the interview with Colonel Fletcher Prouty, who is immortalized in the Oliver Stone film. Of course, he never sat on the park bench, but he did apparently get in touch with Garrison and encourage him to pursue his quest for the truth about what happened to the murder with the murder of an American president. How could this have happened? Why, he would only get away with this if there was a vast conspiracy. But how could a conspiracy be this vast? Well, behind everything going on are powerful spirits of forces, and until you understand that, you can't understand anything going on. Of course, much of this is covered in my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. You need to understand we're involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. We're moving rapidly towards a world government with a loss of all freedom. That's the reason they aren't guiding our borders. That's the reason they're trying to create a multicultural and multilingual society. And while American boys are fighting and dying in Afghanistan and Iraq, supposedly for freedom and to bring democracy to the people of the Middle East, we are losing our freedom here at home as we move towards a police state and spying on the individuals and take away our freedom and advancing the power of the National Security Agency and the military, who are collecting dossiers on every citizen in the United States, but all in the name of fighting that wicked Osama bin Laden, who's living somewhere in a cave in Pakistan, or is it Iran, or where is Osama bin Laden, and why are we trying to catch him? I thought we started the whole war on terrorism to catch Osama bin Laden, and we can find all of his assistants, but we just can't find Osama bin Laden or his right-hand man, his sidekick. And it wasn't Tonto, it was al-Zawahiri, Dr. al-Zawahiri, who incidentally had been allowed to come to the United States in 1995 and collect money and travel all over the country, even though he was a known terrorist and wanted for murder, and they knew that when they brought him in here. And if you doubt that, we'll be glad to provide you the clipping out of, I think it was the New York Times we have. That's where I read all the newspapers, because once in a while they have to tell the truth. And if you want the documentation for anything we say on these programs, you can always give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And certainly if you'd like to get a free copy of our newsletter, our latest newsletter is on Iraq. Just give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to know the master plan of the occult hierarchy for the New World, how they plan to redistribute your wealth and impoverish you, that's point 10A of the Earth Charter. We'll be glad to send you a copy of the Earth Charter free of charge. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, and then please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and our ministers, but pray for my ministry of Radio Liberty, for our provision and for our protection. And so, until we're together again, may the Lord be with you. Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us on the line Dr. Gary Goldman. And Dr. Goldman is a research scientist. He had done a great deal of work studying the background of the chickenpox vaccine and the chickenpox disease. And of course, we are vaccinating all of our children for chickenpox. We're told that this is a wonderful accomplishment. We've pretty well done away with chickenpox, and isn't it a wonderful thing that we've done with this vaccination? And Dr. Goldman's job was to verify that fact. But as he began analyzing the statistics he found from rather extensive studies, he began to find out that, well, if you stop and thought about it, I mean, your chance of dying of chickenpox is about the same as less than your chance of being struck by lightning here in the United States. Chickenpox is not that serious a disease, but there seem to be some complications, especially as far as the relationship to shingles in people who've actually either had the vaccination, or in the adult population who no longer has the stimulus of exposure to chickenpox. So before I tell the whole story, Dr. Goldman, thank you so very much for being with us this evening.
Yes, it's my pleasure.
Why don't you just sort of introduce yourself to our listeners? Who are you? You certainly are a research scientist, and you've done a great job. I've read all your papers, but I want you to tell our listeners what this is really all about and why you saw fit to write the papers and try to expose the fact that maybe we're not getting the whole story.
Well, I'll try to be somewhat brief. My background, my PhD is in computer science. I also have a double degree, a Bachelor of Science in both engineering and computer science. And what happened was, back in 1995, I had the opportunity to join a study project doing epidemiological studies and active surveillance of chickenpox disease called varicella with a local health department funded by the CDC. And that was to basically try to find trends associated with the ongoing use of the vaccine, which started in from the licensure of the vaccine in March of 1995.
Well, now, of course, I remember when I was practicing medicine, we were never very worried about chickenpox. Everybody got it. Occasionally somebody might get a little stiff neck, but you didn't get a serious encephalitis or problems with it. And, it was a very, very mild disease, and people got well, and then they never got it again. So why did we vaccinate everybody?
Well, basically, the cost analysis was done with several assumptions. Basically, the vaccine was authorized due to the time it saved parents from losing work and having to be with their children. So it was not really justified on a medical health basis, but more of a time loss from work.
All right, fine. We're going to be back in just a moment with Dr. Gary Goldman. And so the reason we're vaccinating the children is so the parents won't lose so much time for work. That's a little sort of stretching the idea, but, well, of course, the planners seem to think it was a good idea. Mm-hmm. Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and our guest is Dr. Gary Goldman, and going into the background of why they wanted a chickenpox vaccine for a very mild and really not a very serious illness, but of course parents had to stay home and look after their children, and it was going to be cost-effective to go ahead and vaccinate all of our children so that the parents wouldn't lose so much time from work. So pick up the story there, Dr. Goldman.
Okay, well, when it was studied further, it was found that approximately 11 to 12,000 of 4 million cases of chickenpox each year resulted in hospitalization, mainly due to infected lesions. And as you brought out in your introduction, approximately 50 cases, that's just over 1/1,000th of 1%, resulted in death in children. Another 50 deaths occurred in adults. So as you mentioned, the risk of being struck and killed by lightning in the U.S. was higher than dying from chickenpox. So what's interesting is that in the first years, chickenpox vaccination appeared fairly successful. Let's see, I basically have some statistics here. Well, in 1995, I can just use some round numbers, we were experiencing in our study population about 2,934 verified and reported cases of chickenpox in 1995. By year 2000, there were just 836 cases. So that was a documented decrease by 72% in our study population. So things seem pretty good. And really, all the data and analyses that I had generated did go through the CDC and the superiors at the public health department and resulted in publications really featuring the positive aspects of varicella vaccination. But just before 2000, I had suggested that it would be nice to track shingles, also called herpes zoster, in the study population. Since 1965, a British doctor, Dr. Hope Simpson, in England, had written that perhaps the frequency of shingles was related to the each group's contact with children with chickenpox.
Now, hold that thought. We'll be right back here in just a moment and discuss this more. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Dr. Gary Goldman, who is, of course, was a research scientist with a PhD in computer technology and computer analysis and statistics. And he was pointing out that the initial studies of chickenpox vaccinating showed that in one study group in 1995, there was certainly, I think, something like a little over 2,000 cases of chickenpox, but you know, over a period of years, it was cut down to about 800. And so it looked like, my goodness, we're really cutting down on the incidence of smallpox, pardon me, of chickenpox. But then, of course, the question arose, what about shingles? And somebody in England had suggested that, you know, people didn't get, people got shingles because they did not have exposure to chickenpox. It's a very, very similar virus. Maybe it's the same virus for that matter. But if you have a constant exposure to the virus, you develop an immunity and you don't get the shingles. If you don't have an exposure to the virus, then you do get shingles. So the question was, now that we've actually really pretty well eradicated the disease or on the road to eradicating it, what's going to happen to the incidence of shingles? And for those of you who do not know what this is, it's we call it herpes zoster, but it's a terribly painful disease we see in elderly people, usually in a radicular pattern. You see a band of vesicles around the wall of the chest cage, and these people are in agonizing pain. And even after the lesions, the chickenpox-like lesions, the vesicles have disappeared, these people are still in anguishing pain. And one of the worst pains imaginable is the pain of herpes zoster or shingles. So it's something you see in older people where their immune system is broken down. So pick up the story there, Dr. Goldman. You begin to wonder, is there any relationship, or what are we going to, what's really going to happen to the incidence of shingles if we then take away the presence of this disease in our society? Does the disease in our society play a part in stimulating the immune system in elderly people so they don't get shingles? Would that be a fair estimate?
Okay, yes, you're right on target. Let me give just a little background. When someone is infected with chickenpox, technically they become infected with what's called the varicella zoster virus. The first time they're infected produces chickenpox, the rash that appears with lesions all over the body. Then it was thought that as you grow older, maybe into your 50s, you have what's called age-related decline of your immune system. And then the same varicella zoster virus that produced chickenpox initially and went dormant can become active. And now you break out in a, could be an excruciating rash in what's called a dermatome along nerve root endings. If it affects the trigeminal nerve, then it's going to affect something in the cranium, in your brain or your head, your eyes. It could affect mouth. It really can affect any nerve location in the body. So it was thought that it was an age-related decline. So as you got older, you tended to have a higher incidence rate of shingles. It turns out that traditional thinking was in error. It seemed to match what was being observed, but the mechanism was not properly understood. In fact, I have a quote here from the last sentence in Dr. Hope Simpson's 1965 paper, The Nature of Herpes Zoster. He said, "The peculiar age distribution of zoster may in part reflect the frequency with which the different age groups encounter cases of varicella, and because of the ensuing boost to their antibody production, have their attacks of zoster postponed." Well, if we put that in plain English, what that means is, let's even take children that have had a case of natural chickenpox. What prevents them from getting shingles is their periodic and sometimes annual exposures to other children with chickenpox in the community during epidemics. It causes an amnestic effect. It piques the body to remember its initial infection, boosts what's called cell-mediated immunity, and then that helps suppress reactivation of shingles. So without children having chickenpox, you lose the natural exposure, that amnestic effect, and your body forgets, your cell-mediated immunity declines, and you would expect more cases of shingles. And in my research with children, children who were not vaccinated, but had the natural disease by year 2000 and 2001, with chickenpox reduced by 70 to 80% in the community, those children under 10 years old were no longer getting effective boost from other children with chickenpox. And their rate of shingles went as high as you would expect in adults 40 or 50 years old. So that was a foreboding result, because all adults have had natural chickenpox. They will lose out on the boost from exposure to children with chickenpox, and so it was estimated there would be an epidemic of shingles among adults.
All right, because we were actually finding a significant increase then in children of shingles, which we never saw. I never saw a case of shingles in a child, and yet, of course, you were actually finding this in children?
Yes, and just to give you an idea of how the health department or even public health reports this, the incidence of shingles, if we take age in children, ages 10 years and younger, is roughly 68 cases per 100,000 children in the population, age 10 and under. The health department was reporting that they were getting shingles rates very close to that rate in year 2000 and 2001. In fact, they actually reported they were getting 40 cases per 100,000. Seemed a little lower. Looked great. The problem is you have two groups of children. Vaccinated children that have a very, very low rate of shingles so far. They have a rate of shingles only around somewhere around 18 to maybe 40 cases per 100,000. But then you had the children with natural chickenpox that were up to 430 cases per 100,000. So when you average the two results, it looks as though everything is normal, when actually it really violates statistics to do an average of bimodal results. Just to put that in English, let's say the news was to report someone drowned in 6 inches of water, which is impossible. But that 6 inches could indeed be the average of a water depth of 15 feet in a few areas and maybe 1 to 2 inches in other areas, averaging out to 6 inches. That 6 inches is not a good estimate of the very shallow water or the very deep. It's a meaningless figure because there are two different types of regions in that lake.
And so the unvaccinated children were then having more in the way of shingles?
Yes, more than it appeared. Their rate at 430 cases per 100,000 was at least 2 to 3 times higher than ever expected in any results in any studies anywhere in the world.
And, of course, the reason for this was because they were not getting a constant exposure to other children that would have the disease and then boosting their immunity. Now, what about the elderly people? What impact did the doing away with the chickenpox in this society have upon the elderly who ordinarily would, I don't know what the rate of the shingles in the elderly was. It wasn't too high, but it was a bothersome amount.
Yes, it's reported anywhere from around 230 for middle-aged adults to about 550 as you approach 50 years of age.
Now, is that per 1,000 or per 10?
Per 100,000.
Per 100,000, okay.
And what happened is the CDC actually did a study, what's called a BRFSS study, a phone study, of a large population, and they found that shingles increased 90% in the adult population between 1998 and, I believe, 2003. As chickenpox vaccination rates increased, shingles went up 90%. In the population I was studying, within 2 years, the shingles rate among adults went above 50%. Higher than it had started.
But apparently there were some people who didn't want to hear these results. In other words, what you were doing was challenging this whole idea of immunizing the whole population with chickenpox, and for whatever reason, this wasn't a very popular message, was it?
Not at all. And in fact, I can give you an example of what was done. I was severely criticized, and just to give you what I was working with, I had collected 2 years of data among a population of 318,000 people, of which 118,000 of those individuals were under the age of 20. So the figure is, I had a population for 2 years with 118,685 individuals under the age of 20. That was criticized. Yet the CDC came out with a small BRFSS study, this phone study, that used only 4,900 residents in 1 year and 3,000 residents the next year in that same age group. They came to the conclusion with those small numbers, less than 5,000 people each year, that there was no increase in shingles. And this was promoted in the media and in other journals, And really, there was no precision in their results. There was no statistical significance because they just did not have enough data to conclude no increase.
Well, do you think that sometimes when we do scientific studies, do you think sometimes when they do the scientific studies, they have a preconceived notion, and they are simply going to distort their conclusion to come up with a preconceived notion? Could it possibly be that science is no longer science? It has to do with being politically correct? Because certainly nobody is to be critical of vaccines today.
Well, I'll tell you, I was very naive. Going into this project, I thought I was with a team that was out to really investigate the truth of the matter concerning varicella and its effect on the community. I came to be extremely disappointed when I resigned, and I resigned on ethical grounds because when research is suppressed or it is not just open to the public for further investigation, you really compromise professional ethics. And what I was finding was all the positive information was being promoted, but yet these manuscripts, I put three together, were never going to formal review, even after 2 years, where other positive information, if a seminar or proceedings was coming up, somehow CDC approval would happen in one day.
In other words, basically, somebody was suppressing your information.
That's what it seemed like it. There were a lot of technical excuses made. Oh, the data's preliminary. Maybe it's there's a preliminary spike in the data. So you could try to justify it. But your words are correct where you say today there's what you could call pseudoscience. There is no any research that is going to affect vaccination rates seems like it's very hard to even get published. The bias also is in the editors of the journals who have ties to pharmaceuticals, and so you will not see many negative reports, just like with the Vioxx situation, and there's been other cases.
And I would simply suggest for any of our listeners out there who would question what Dr. Goldman is saying, there's a wonderful book written by Dr. Marcia Angel, formerly the editor of the New England Journal of Medicine. And Dr. Angel, who has a staff appointment at Harvard University, wrote a book called The Truth About the Drug Companies. The Truth About the Drug Companies. And I will tell you, I think maybe it's what you should know about the drug companies. And they put so much pressure on her, they made her life so miserable for daring to come out and be critical of the drug companies that, she will not even answer her emails. Now, Dr. Goldman, of course, has tried to bring out the fact that there are some serious questions about the impact of chickenpox vaccine, which to begin with was justified only in the fact it was going to save the time lost from work for adults. And then, of course, we're beginning to see an increase in the incidence of shingles, this terrible, terrible disease in the elderly, because they're not exposed to the infection, the stimulation of their immune system by contacting with children with varicella. So as we begin to interfere with the normal course of this disease, while we begin to produce other diseases and serious consequences, we'll be back in just a moment here with Dr. Goldman. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, Dr. Goldman then, of course, did not get his articles published through the CDC. He resigned on an ethical basis because he felt that when there was a conscious effort to conceal the truth, conceal science for political considerations, and as Dr. Goldman pointed out, many times the people who are on the editorial boards of these various magazines have a tie-in to the vaccine manufacturing companies, and they have a conflict of interest. And this is a real problem in science today, isn't it, Dr. Goldman, that there's so many people who profess to be scientists, whether they're getting paid or getting grants or getting all sorts of benefits from the drug companies and vaccine manufacturers?
Yes. Let me tell you my experience. When I wrote these papers and wanted to give authorship credit to the group, later, just before publication, I got a note from the county legal office to cease and desist publication in a medical journal, which was an amazing find because of the Freedom of Information Act, because it was financed by the CDC. Really, the data could not be claimed to be privileged and confidential. So with an attorney, I was able to go ahead with three manuscripts on the topic. Then later, I came out with a cost-benefit analysis taking into account the shingles aspect. And with one call of the CDC to an editor, that was postponed 2 years from going to print, and then finally did make it to print. So there is a lot of suppression. What's interesting, let me tell you this. They talk about the vaccine efficacy, how efficient and effective the varicella vaccine is. And I'll tell you, the vaccine was extremely effective. In the beginning, in fact, it's touted as being retaining immunity in a vaccinee for as much as 20 years or longer. That result comes from Japan, where in 1980, one out of five Japanese children, that's 20%, were given the varicella vaccine. And 20 years later, their immunity levels were higher than when they were initially vaccinated. Well, the interesting thing there is, for those 20 years, the four out of five that weren't vaccinated still contributed to high incidence of the natural disease, which boosted the vaccinees. In the U.S., what happened in 1995 was the acceptance of the universal varicella vaccination program, whereby every healthy child 12 months and older would be given the vaccine. So eventually the boosting effect would die out. But so a lot of the hype and propaganda comes from a study where chickenpox was still in epidemic stages, in annual epidemics in Japan throughout each year. So let's see, I had a final paper published in the International Journal of Toxicology where I looked at the vaccine effectiveness by year. Now the CDC did a similar paper. It was called Contagiousness of Varicella, where they reported one rate, I think somewhere around 80% effectiveness over the entire period, saying there was no trend. It remained at 80%. When I looked at it by year, though, what I found was a very interesting result. The vaccine effectiveness, I have it in front of me here, in 1997 was at 86.7%. In 1998, it went up 93.7%. In 1999, it went up again 95.7%. Very high, and it looks great in terms of vaccine efficacy. But in those years, the natural varicella was still common in the community. So you have what's called this predicted honeymoon effect, where the vaccinees are still being boosted by children with natural chickenpox. By year 2000, the cases severely dropped, in natural chickenpox dropped, and so did the vaccine efficacy. It dropped by 10%, from 95 to 85% in 2000. Then it dropped another more than 10% in 2001 to 73%. Then it dropped another more than 10%, finally to 58.4% in 2002.
In other words, it did not give universal coverage at all.
Well, it lost its effectiveness when it was no longer being boosted by children having natural chickenpox.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here in just a moment with Dr. Gary Goldman. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, Dr. Gary Goldman. And, of course, this is a fascinating story as we begin to see what is the real impact of the varicella vaccine. Are we really helping children? Well, of course, the efficiency of the vaccine has dropped and dropped dramatically. Now, when you're talking about, the more later studies where, it's only 50-some percent effective, you mean then we were still getting a large number of cases of chickenpox, is that right?
Yes. And in fact, let me tell you just another interesting anecdote here. In the CDC study, technically, they were correct in that there was no trend, especially this 20% drop in efficacy, when you consider what in statistics is called the 95% confidence interval. But that's an artificially selected number. And I found that there was statistical significance at the 94% confidence interval. So if people are in statistics, you can manipulate statistics, but there was indeed a trend. And what this means is really, there's been talk of this, that a second dose of varicella vaccine may be required in children up through age 12, whereas currently only one dose has been recommended. For over 12 years, then two doses are recommended. Also, what we find is a very interesting thing. The adults who have shingles can transmit the natural strain to vaccinated children. When children are vaccinated, they receive what's called the OCA, or attenuated vaccine strain, a very diminished strain of varicella that, if the child does have an outbreak, it produces only a few lesions. What happens is, though, when they're introduced to the natural virus, it can be heterologous, or sufficiently different in genetic makeup, so that the child actually becomes infected with the natural virus on top of the vaccine attenuated virus. Therefore, the natural virus becomes the dominant virus. This is all masked, though, because the vaccine is sufficient in many cases to suppress an outbreak of the chickenpox.
All right, hold that thought right there. We'll be back in just a moment with Dr. Gary Goldman. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest is Dr. Gary Goldman. And Dr. Goldman, do you have a website if any of our listeners would like to get in touch with you, or at least to learn more about your work?
Okay, I do have a website associated with a independent medical journal that of which I'm editor-in-chief. That's at www.medicalveritas, spelled V-E-R-I-T-A-S, .com. Medical Veritas, all one word. They can feel free to email me, too. Should I give that out?
You go right ahead.
It's Pear Blossom, Inc., spelled P-E-A-R, B-L-O-S-S-O-M-I-N-C, at AOL.com.
At AOL.com, all right. And, of course, Veritas is a word meaning truth.
Yes.
And, of course, this is really what we're all about. We are not getting the truth on many of these things. Dr. Goldman is a very courageous gentleman, a very courageous scientist, because he was willing to give up, I'm sure, a very profitable job just on the basis of principles, because he realized that accurate information was being actively suppressed. Our telephone number, if you'd like to give us a call, if you have a question about this, is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And we have calling from Allentown, Pennsylvania, Roger. Hi, Roger. How are you doing?
Thank you, gentlemen. And this is really excellent. Helps clarify quite a few things. Could you, and this would hopefully clarify one more, that is, would you say, like, for the geriatric shingles, that this is, as it were, not having the previous exposure, it's like having virtually a virgin exposure, and that there goes out the window the argument that this was bringing the old virions out of dormancy?
Well, let me tell you how this works. Older adults that are active in the community, for instance, we can take a study in physicians. Normally, at age 50 or so, they would have 550 cases per 100,000. A 60-year-old or 70, it can be 1,000 to 1,500 cases per 100,000 due to theirs an age-related decline. But because they're active in the community, their rate can actually approach that of 20-year-olds, maybe only 200 cases per 100,000. So what was happening is all the older adults were getting a natural boost anytime they had a periodic exposure to a child with chickenpox. What they proposed is now they're going to have a shingles vaccination. That, in many cases, will simply make up for the higher incidence that was created as a result of the universal varicella vaccination.
But, of course, this whole thing really seems so absurd. I mean, we vaccinate everybody not because we're worried about the child. We're concerned about the people, of course, that, are going to lose work taking care of the children with the chicken pox. And now we're going to have to come up with a second immunization for the children because, of course, they don't have this constant stimulation. We're going to have to come up with another vaccine for the elderly so they don't get the shingles because they're not exposed to normal chicken pox. Seems to me that the more we do, the more problems we have.
Yes, really, there's a cycle of treatment and then like a cure and then a treatment again. And I should say, too, that the problem is even with younger adults. And to vaccinate all the adult population at roughly $200 per dose for that shingles vaccine, because it has many more plaque-forming units, so it's a more expensive vaccine, really amounts to a huge cost, more so than what the disease was producing.
I mean, it seems to me that it wasn't really costing that much to begin with. A few parents would have to lose a little bit of time from work looking after their children. And now, of course, we wonder why the health care costs are going up so high. Everything we do raises the cost even more. And I'm not entirely sure that vaccines are entirely without some complications as far as the immune system, because we're really mobilizing the immune system. We've seen a fantastic increase in the incidence of asthma. Asthma is constantly increasing. Asthma is an autoimmune disease. And what we're doing is really attacking the immune system with these vaccines. Maybe we're creating more problems than we're really helping. Is that possible?
Yes, it is. And there are several that have come to that conclusion. There's a physician and consultant in France, Dr. Marc Girard, and he had put out a paper dealing with the fact that we recognize vaccinations are supposed to produce long-lasting immunity, but they're never studied for the long-term detrimental effects that they have. And using French data, he showed that there was a correlation with the autoimmune risks of vaccination, which are often overlooked. It turns out an editor called into the journal he was publishing in and was able to cancel his publication with that one call. He got a one-line response that his manuscript or his letter was canceled. And he wrote me, he said, I'll quote him, "This should be a matter of concern for every scientist that an unidentified advice is sufficient to justify the rejection of a paper at this step of the publication process. This would be all the more so since apparently the editor responsible for this unusual shift in publication rules claims to be in charge of teaching scientific ethics.
Anything else, Roger?
Yeah, just would you have good reason to be able to categorically reject the standard issue line of this is 60-year-old virions being brought out of dormancy resulting in shingles?
All right, thank you so much, Roger. And of course, what Roger is saying, what we're ordinarily told is that these are simply the virions that have been there latent for many years. And actually, certainly as many people as they get older, their immune system declines. And of course, 77, I realize this is a factor in myself, but we take all sorts of things to maintain our immune system, and I will have to admit that everybody else around me gets ill, and I seem for some reason or other not to get ill, because we take all sorts of immune system boosters, and I think every elderly person should be doing that. Would you agree with that, Dr. Goldman?
Well, I can tell you, just in my focus of research, that only 1 to 2, maybe a few periodic exposures to chickenpox seems to be sufficient to protect an adult for up to 10 years.
And so would be better off any time one of the neighbor's children comes down with chickenpox to go over and give him a hug, huh?
Right, and here's the interesting thing. The children with natural chickenpox are most infectious 1 to 2 days before they outbreak their rash. So you may never know who you were standing in line with or near that gave you the boost. But like I said, even physicians, older ones, age 50, 60, still practicing, have the protection and are able to postpone the onset of shingles as if they were 20 or 30 year olds, like parents with children, because their clients, as pediatricians, they're getting many exposures.
Well, I think your work is really seminal. I think it's so vitally important that people understand that, you know, between man's plan in time and God's plan in eternity, there's an infinite quality of difference. And here we have a lot of well-meaning people. Oh, we're just going to do away with chickenpox, and we're going to save all those parents all the time that's lost from work. And look where we've gone, and you know, we've taken away the stimulating effect of chickenpox, which was actually prophylactic for the elderly in preventing the shingles. And now, of course, it's no longer there, where the elderly are getting a dramatic increase in this terrible, painful disease. And talk about, you know, agony. I've seen these people literally weep and plead for pain pills, anything to get rid of the pain.
Yes, there's another important point. Man does not really understand the immune system that well. And there's a very novel finding by a author with the last name Wrench, W-R-E-N-S-C-H, who found that adults who have never had chickenpox actually had gliomas or brain tumors at a much higher incidence than adults that had chickenpox. The brain tumor pathogenesis wasn't fully understood. But sometimes, maybe a chickenpox-like disease mimics other virus patterns that the body can get rid of. And so, without having exposure to chickenpox, it does seem these individuals are prone to the gliomas, fast-growing brain tumors.
And so that if you had the immunity to chickenpox,
you tend not to get those.
You tend not to get those. In other words, your body has the immune response that perhaps would suppress the formation. There's just so much going on out there we don't understand. And I'm sure that most of the people involved in this are well-meaning. What bothers me, though, is the conscious effort to suppress information from the public. Now, did you eventually get all of your work published?
Yes, with the help of a wonderful attorney who also served in some years as a judge with 30 years experience, he claimed that he would have filed false claim acts for state and on the state and federal level, and then I never did get another response to the cease and desist order. But it didn't stop there. Then the CDC wrote what they called a scientific commentary, initially trying to slur my position and name, and then that was taken out of the commentary, and then they proceeded to try to provide some scientific basis on which the research could be rejected. I was allowed by the editor, though, to write a point-by-point rebuttal. What's interesting, CDC even commented that I was in error in the methodology and other aspects, and they even commented on a study for which they didn't even have the data or understand how I had processed the data to avoid the bias they stated existed.
In other words, if you don't like the message, why, you attack the messenger, you vilify
right.
the messenger, you demonize the messenger. Ladies and gentlemen, we're talking about science, we're talking about human lives, we're talking about human suffering, and the people of the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control are doing everything they can to demonize Dr. Goldman, who's trying to get the truth out because of his concern that maybe, just maybe, this whole process started out meaning well and has done, is like opening a can of worms, and now the genie's out of the bottle and the toothpaste is out of the tube, and we got a real problem. So what's going to happen now? Are we just going to continue doing this and maybe give an additional chickenpox immunization to every child so they get a booster, and then start giving the shingles immunization? What's the cost of this going to be? Where's the money going to come from?
You know, what the shame is, this efficacy, with it decreasing, it means that as the children get older, their protection is going to wane or diminish. And then they'll be more susceptible to disease, to chickenpox, at an older age, which then you have many more complications and problems. Also, childbearing women have the potential, if they got chickenpox in their first trimester of pregnancy, to have a child with varicella syndrome, where they do have, in a small percentage, deformed limbs and other problems.
So it's just one complication leads to another complication leads to another complication. I mean, we had a pretty good system before. Everybody got chickenpox, or just about everybody got chickenpox, and of course we had a few people that would have a complication, but it was extremely rare. And as Dr. Goldman has pointed out, and we mentioned at the beginning of the program, your chance of dying either as a child or as an adult from chickenpox was far less than being the chance you're being struck and dying from a lightning bolt in this country. I mean, it was very, very rare. So it was a non-problem, really, if you looked at it. And now, of course, we're even talking about, of course, the incidence now of maternal abnormalities as far as these children. Is this as much of a problem as, does this happen very often today?
Well, again, talking about varicella, you're bringing out an interesting point. In the United States, there's what's called the adverse vaccine event reporting system. Actually, it's called VAERS, the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, which handles cases of vaccine reaction that are usually reported by the doctor, but it could be reported by the patient. Unfortunately, only 5 to 10% of the adverse reactions are reported. And then, really, there's no follow-up. So I've heard of cases where a 35-year-old received the vaccine and had muscle weakness. Another man was actually permanently disabled. Another person, numerous problems started of an autoimmune nature occurred, and she remained disabled. What was interesting, she was on a varicella study project herself and was healthy when the project started. So it goes on. And the VAERS reporting system, let's see, I show that there's 2,350 cases per year, adverse reports on varicella alone.
And, of course, that's probably only 5%, so
right.
You might multiply that by 20,000.
Yes.
About 20, so you're talking about 100,000.
Right.
And so this is really a problem that we've compounded by what we've done. And Dr. Goldman is on the front lines at trying to get this information out. And what sort of response are you getting from the general medical community as you try to get the information out, especially the fact that the CDC has gone to such lengths to try to discredit and demonize you?
Well, the scientific manuscripts stand on their own, and some editors in some cases have referred to my article, so that in papers that try to be overly optimistic, they're citing my research and telling the authors go back and make it more realistic.
Do we have any idea how much money is involved in this? Because it must be a great deal of money to be made in these vaccines. Could that be in any way influencing what's happening?
Well, I'll tell you what happens. The CDC is able to purchase vaccine from the vaccine manufacturers at a special rate. Through the Vaccines for Children, a federally funded program, they're able to then distribute vaccine to the local health departments, who in turn distribute it to doctors. So everyone's going to get paid, because if there's any financial difficulty, the government will step in. So with the varicella vaccine at $50 a dose for every child born, $4 million per year, that's a large sum of money.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Dr. Gary Goldman. We're just about out of time, but we've got about 3 minutes to wrap up. Listen, Dr. Goldman is commenting that at $50 a dose for the vaccine for what, 4 million children a year?
Yes.
That really runs up to about $200 million, doesn't it?
Yes. And what's interesting is if increase has indeed if herpes zoster has indeed increased incidence and approaches a 100% increase, the same manufacturer produces acyclovir or Zovirax, the antiviral that's used to treat shingles. So that's a win-win situation there. Then on top of that, you then have a vaccine to offset the shingles vaccine to offset the varicella vaccine. Now you have another marketable product.
And of course, the more you go into this thing, the more you begin to wonder, is this really an effort to help people, or is there perhaps some at least financial motivation in what's going on today? So certainly we would encourage people to get more in the way of information, to look into this and find out what the truth really is. And of course, the truth about the drug companies is a very important book, and you begin to realize, of course, that they spend far more money on the marketing than they do on research. And of course, but when you've got a vaccine that's approved by the CDC, it's like a cash cow. And of course, now you've got one vaccine, it creates another problem, then you can come up with another vaccine. Dr. Goldman, you got a minute to wrap up this incredible program.
Well, all I can say is it's going to be hard to duplicate the natural protection that was offered in the community through the natural chickenpox. And what we have here is the case of one vaccine, the varicella vaccine, causing another vaccine to be used to offset its deleterious or negative effects.
And my concern is the fact that any mention at all of the fact that we are really changing the whole immune structure of the human body, and of course anybody who mentions this or mentions the dramatic increase in asthma, which everybody knows, every scientist knows, that it's increasing, and nobody ever asks why, nobody ever asks is there a relationship between the fact that we're stimulating the immune system artificially and then we're seeing all the people crippled with asthma. Gary, Dr. Goldman, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Well, thank you.
And we hope we can get you onto one of our other programs.
Okay.
Good night.
Good night.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. I hope you enjoyed our interview with Dr. Coleman. And we have four tape sets on vaccines. We have four tape sets on autism. We have four tape sets on the mercury that is in the vaccines. Of course, you need to understand that they are doing everything, in my estimation, to harm our children. And people say, why would anybody want to harm our children? And I would say, why would anybody want to push abortion? They want to kill the children. They're not interested in a woman's choice. The same Planned Parenthood organization that pushes a choice for women here in America and a woman's right to do with what she wants to with her body is over in China, backing the Chinese one-child policy, of course, where they women are forced to abort their children, and initially were actually, in many instances, put in a situation where they had to kill their girl children. Yes, there really are people out there who would like to harm children. And as incredible as it may seem, we are involved in a spiritual battle, being fought on a political, ideological, cultural, but on a medical battlefield, on a public health battlefield, and you out there listening audience must understand what we're up against. Please go to my website, radioliberty.com, pull my Population Control Agenda monograph down. That's the Population Control Agenda monograph. Understand the truth about the vaccines. There's a wonderful book called The Virus and the Vaccines. We have a pamphlet called Genetic Engineering. It goes into all the diseases that have actually been created in secret laboratories. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, there really are secret laboratories out there. And when somebody like Dr. Goldman comes up with solid facts to point out the danger of vaccines, of varicella vaccine, and everything is done to actually attack him, and lawyers are involved to tell him he cannot publish his material. Why? Because they don't know the truth, and that's why I do what I do 5 hours a day. And quite frankly, we do need your help to maintain the level that we have. We have almost 60 outlets every single week where at least a small part of the American people are getting the truth, the information you're never going to get from the controlled media. So we do hope that many of you, of course, will certainly give us a call at 1-800-544-8927 and learn more about our ministry. If you'd like to get a free copy of our latest newsletter, which goes into the background of what's really going on in Iraq, and as our boys are going overseas to fight in Iraq and in Afghanistan, we are losing our freedom here at home. Because there is a master plan. What is the master plan? There is an occult hierarchy that rules the world. And if you have not seen my articles on the occult hierarchy in May and June of last year, or seen the pamphlet we put together, why they're available through Radio Liberty. But more than that, the plan is to bring about a one-world government and a one-world religion and the destruction of Christianity, and with that, the destruction of the sovereignty of our nation and of our freedom. Out of a large part of our population. You must understand we are involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Western civilization. So we ask you to go to our website at radioliberty.com. Remember our number, 1-800-544-8927. And then please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and our ministers. But please pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until we're together again, may the Lord be with you.